another. At times, he was so tortured, his sword seemed like a weapon turned against him. Among the possibilities he had considered was choosing the easy way. If he could bring himself to live in a comfortable, ordinary way with Otsu, life would be simple. Almost any fief would be willing to pay him enough to live on, perhaps 500 to 1,000 bushels. But when he put it to himself in the form of a question, the answer was always no. An easy existence imposed restrictions. He could not submit to them. At other times, he felt as lost in base, craven illusions as the hungry demons in hell. Then, for a time, his mind would clear, and he would bask in the pleasure of his proud isolation. In his heart, there was a continual struggle between light and dark. Night and day, he wavered between exuberance and melancholy. He'd think of his swordsmanship and be dissatisfied. Thinking of how long the way was, how far he was from maturity, a sickness came over his heart. Other days, the mountain life cheered him and his thoughts strayed to Otsu. Coming down from the mountains, he'd gone to the Yugyoji in Fujisawa for a few days, then on to Kamakura. It was here that he'd met Matahachi. Determined not to return to a life of indolence, Matahachi was in Kamakura because of the many Zen temples there, but he was suffering from an even deeper sense of malaise than Musashi. Musashi reassured him, "It's not too late. If you learn self-discipline, you can make a fresh start. It's fatal to tell yourself that it's all over, that you're no good." He felt constrained to add, "To tell the truth, I myself have run up against a wall. There are times when I wonder if I have any future. I feel completely empty. It's like being confined in a shell. I hate myself. I tell myself I'm no good. But by chastising myself and forcing myself to go on, I manage to kick through the shell. Then a new path opens up before me. Believe me, it's a real struggle this time. I'm floundering around inside the shell, unable to do a thing. I came down from the mountains because I remembered a person who I think can help me." The person was the priest Gudo. Matahachi said, "He's the one who helped you when you were first seeking the way, isn't he? Couldn't you introduce me and ask him to accept me as his disciple?" At first, Musashi was skeptical about Matahachi's sincerity, but after hearing of the trouble he'd been in Edo, he decided that he really meant it. The two of them made inquiries about Gudo at a number of Zen temples, but learned little. Musashi knew the priest was no longer at the Myoshinji in Kyoto. He had left several years earlier and traveled for some time in the east and northeast. He also knew he was a most erratic man, who might be in Kyoto giving lectures on Zen to the emperor one day and out wandering the countryside the next. Gudo had been known to stop several times at the Hachioji in Okazaki, and one priest suggested that might be the best place to wait for him. Musashi and Matahachi sat in the little shed where Matahachi slept. Musashi often visited him here, and they talked late into the night. Matahachi wasn't allowed to sleep in the dormitory, which, like the other buildings of the Hachioji, was a rustic, thatched roof affair, since he had not yet been officially accepted as a priest.
"Oh, these mosquitoes!" said Matahachi, waving away smoke from the insect repellent, then rubbing his irritated eyes. "Let's go outside!"
They walked to the main hall and sat down on the porch. The grounds were deserted, and there was a cool breeze.
"Reminds me of the Shippoji," said Matahachi, his voice barely audible. "It does, doesn't it?" said Musashi.
They fell silent. They always did at times like this, thoughts of home invariably bringing back memories of Otsu or Osugi, or events neither of them wanted to talk about for fear of upsetting their present relationship. But after a few moments, Matahachi said,
The hill the Shippoji was on was higher, wasn't it? There isn't any ancient cryptomeria here, though.
He paused, stared for a time at Musashi's profile, then said diffidently,
There's a request I've been wanting to make, but...
What is it?
Otsu...
Matahachi began, but immediately choked up. When he thought he could manage it, he went on.
I wonder what Otsu's doing right now, and what will happen to her. I think of her often these days, apologizing in my heart for what I did. I'm ashamed to admit it, but in Edo, I made her live with me. Nothing happened, though. She refused to let me touch her. I guess after I went to Sekigahara, Otsu must have been like a fallen blossom. Now she's a flower blooming on a different tree, in a different soil.
His face showed his earnestness, and his voice was grave.
Takezo, no, Musashi, I beg you, marry Otsu. You're the only person who can save her. I've never been able to bring myself to say that, but now that I've decided to become a disciple of Gudo, I'm resigned to the fact that Otsu is not mine. Even so, I worry about her. Won't you look for her and give her the happiness she longs for?
It was about 3 o'clock in the morning when Musashi started down the dark mountain path. His arms were folded, his head was bowed. Matahachi's words rang in his ears. Anguish seemed to tug at his legs. He wondered how many nights of torment Matahachi must have spent mustering up the courage to speak. Yet it seemed to Musashi that his own dilemma was uglier and more painful. Matahachi, he thought, was hoping to flee from the flames of the past to the cool salvation of enlightenment, trying, like a baby being born, to find in the twofold mysterious pain of sadness and ecstasy a life worth living. Musashi had not been able to say, I can't do that, much less, I don't want to marry Otsu, she's your fiancée. Repent, purify your heart, and win her back. In the end, he had said nothing, for anything he might have said would have been a lie. Matahachi had pleaded fervently,
Unless I'm sure Otsu will be cared for, it'll do me no good to become a disciple. You're the one who urged me to train and discipline myself. If you're my friend, save Otsu. That's the only way to save me.
Musashi had been surprised when Matahachi had broken down and wept. He hadn't suspected he was capable of such depth of feeling. And when he'd stood up to leave, Matahachi clutched his sleeve and begged for an answer.
Let me think about it, was all Musashi could say.
Now he cursed himself for being a coward and lamented his inability to overcome his inertia. Musashi thought sadly that those who have not suffered from this malady cannot know its agony. It was not a matter merely of being idle, which is often a pleasant state, but of wanting desperately to do something and not be able to. Musashi's mind and eyes seemed dull and empty. Having gone as far as he could in one direction, he found himself powerless either to retreat or to embark on a new path. It was like being imprisoned in a place with no exit. His frustration bred self-doubt, recrimination, tears. Getting angry with himself, recalling all the things he had done wrong, did not help. It was because he was experiencing early symptoms of his ailment that he had parted with Iori and Gonnosuke and severed ties with his friends in Edo. But his intention to kick through the shell before it was well formed had failed. The shell was still there, enclosing his empty self like the abandoned skin of a cicada. He walked on irresolutely. The wide expanse of the Yahagi River came into view, and the wind coming off the river felt cool on his face. Suddenly, warned by a piercing whistle, he leapt to one side. The shot passed within 5 feet of him, and the report of a musket reverberated across the river. Counting two breaths between the bullet and the sound, Musashi concluded the gun had been fired from quite a distance. He jumped under the bridge and clung bat-like to a post. Several minutes passed before three men came running down Hachijo Hill like pine cones driven by the wind. Near the end of the bridge, they stopped and began searching for the body. Convinced he'd scored a hit, the musketeer threw away the fuse. He was dressed in darker clothes than the other two and masked, only his eyes visible. The sky had lightened a little, and brass ornaments on the gun butt gave off a soft glow. Musashi couldn't imagine who in Okazaki wanted him dead. Not that there was any shortage of candidates. In the course of his battles, he had defeated many men who might still burn with the desire for revenge. He had killed many others whose families or friends might wish to pursue a vendetta. Any person who followed the way of the sword was constantly in danger of being killed. If he survived one close call, chances were that by that very act he made new enemies or created a new peril. Danger was the grindstone on which the swordsman whetted his spirit. Enemies were teachers in disguise. To be taught by danger to be alert even when asleep, to learn from enemies at all times, to use the sword as a means of letting people live. Governing the realm, achieving enlightenment, sharing one's joys in life with others, they were all inherent in the way of the sword. As Musashi crouched under the bridge, the cold reality of the situation stimulated him and his lassitude evaporated. Breathing very shallowly, noiselessly, he let his attackers approach. Failing to find the corpse, they searched the deserted road and the space under the end of the bridge. Musashi's eyes widened. Though dressed in black like bandits, the men carried samurai swords and were well shod. The only samurai in the district were those serving the House of Honda in Okazaki and the Owari House of Tokugawa in Nagoya. He was not aware of having enemies in either fief. One man dived into the shadows and recovered the fuse, then lit it and waved it, leading Musashi to think there were more men across the bridge. He couldn't move, not now anyway. If he showed himself, he would invite more musket fire. Even if he gained the opposite bank, danger, perhaps greater danger, lay waiting. But he couldn't stay where he was much longer either. Knowing he had not crossed the bridge, they would move in on him and possibly discover his hiding place. His plan came to him like a flash of light. It was not reasoned out by the theories of the art of war, which constituted the fiber of the trained warrior's intuition. To reason out a mode of attack was a dilatory process, often resulting in defeat in situations where speed was of the essence. The warrior's instinct was not to be confused with animal instinct. Like a visceral reaction, it came from a combination of wisdom and discipline. It was an ultimate reasoning that went beyond reason, the ability to make the right move in a split second without going through the actual process of thinking.
"There's no point in your trying to hide," he shouted. "If you're looking for me, I'm right here."
The wind was fairly strong now. He wasn't sure whether his voice carried or not. The question was answered by another shot. Musashi, of course, was no longer there. While the bullet was still in the air, he jumped 9 feet nearer the end of the bridge. He rushed into their midst. They separated slightly, facing him from three directions, but totally lacking in coordination. He struck downward at the man in the middle with his long sword, simultaneously slicing laterally with his short sword at the man on his left. The third man fled across the bridge, running, stumbling, and bouncing off the railing. Musashi followed at a walk, keeping to one side and stopping from time to time to listen. When nothing more happened, he went home and to bed. The next morning, two samurai appeared at his house. Finding the entranceway full of children's sandals, they went around to the side.
"Are you Muka-sensei?" asked one. "We're from the house of Honda."
Musashi looked up from his writing and said,
"Yes, I'm Muka."
"Is your real name Miyamoto Musashi? If it is, don't try to conceal it."
"I'm Musashi."
"I believe you're acquainted with Watari Shima."
"I don't think I know him."
"He says he's been at 2 or 3 haiku parties when you were present."
"Well, now that you mention it, I do remember him.
We met at the house of a mutual friend. He was wondering if you wouldn't come and spend an evening with him."
"If he's looking for someone to compose haiku with, he has the wrong man. Though it's true I've been invited to a few such parties, I'm a simple man with little experience in such matters."
"I think what he has in mind is discussing the martial arts with you."
Musashi's pupils were staring worriedly at the two samurai. For a few moments, Musashi gazed at them too, then said,
"In that case, I shall be delighted to call on him."
"When?"
"Could you come this evening?"
"Fine." "He'll send a palanquin for you."
"That's very kind of him. I'll be waiting."
After they'd gone, he turned back to his pupils.
"Come now," he said. "You mustn't let yourselves be distracted. Get back to work. Look at me. I'm practicing too. You have to learn to concentrate so completely that you don't even hear people talking or cicadas singing. If you're lazy when you're young, you'll turn out like me and have to practice after you're grown."
He laughed and looked around at the ink-smeared faces and hands. By twilight, he had donned a hakama and was ready to go. Just as he was reassuring the brush seller's wife, who looked ready to cry, that he would be safe, the palanquin arrived. Not the simple basket type seen around town, but a lacquered sedan chair, which was accompanied by 2 samurai and 3 attendants. Neighbors, dazzled by the sight, crowded around and whispered. Children called their friends and chattered excitedly.
"Only great people ride in palanquins like that.
Our teacher must be somebody.
Where's he going? Will he ever come back?"
The samurai closed the door of the palanquin, cleared the people out of the way, and they set off. While not knowing what to expect, Musashi suspected there was a connection between the invitation and the incident at Yahagi Bridge. Perhaps Shima was going to take him to task for killing 2 Honda samurai. Then again, maybe Shima was the person behind the spying and the surprise attack, and was now ready to confront Musashi openly. Not believing any good would come from tonight's meeting, Musashi resigned himself to facing a difficult situation. Speculation wouldn't get him very far. The art of war demanded that he find out where he stood and act accordingly. The palanquin rocked gently, like a boat at sea. Hearing the wind soughing through the pines, he thought they must be in the forest near the north castle wall. He did not look like a man bracing himself for an unpredictable onslaught. Eyes half shut, he appeared to be dozing. After the castle gate grated open, the pace of the bearers was slower, the samurai's tones more subdued. They passed flickering lanterns and came to the castle buildings. When Musashi alighted, servants ushered him silently but politely to an open pavilion. Since the blinds were rolled up on all 4 sides, the breeze wafted through in pleasant waves. The lamps dimmed and flared riotously. It did not seem like the sweltering summer night it was.
"I am Watari Shima," said his host.
He was a typical Mikawa samurai, sturdy, virile, alert, but not ostensibly so, betraying no signs of weakness.
"I am Miyamoto Musashi."
The equally simple reply was accompanied by a bow. Shima returned the bow, said,
"Make yourself comfortable,"
and proceeded to the point without further formalities.
"I am told you killed 2 of our samurai last night. Is that true?"
Yes, it is. Musashi stared at Shima's eyes.
I owe you an apology, said Shima gravely. I heard about the incident today when the deaths were reported. There was an investigation, of course. Though I've known your name for a long time, I did not know until now that you were living in Okazaki. As for the attack, I was told you were fired on by a group of our men, one of whom is a disciple of Miyake Gunbei, a martial expert of the Togun style.
Musashi, sensing no subterfuge, accepted Shima's words at face value, and the story unfolded gradually. Gunbei's disciple was one of several Honda samurai who had studied at the Yoshioka school. The firebrands among them got together and decided to kill the man who had put an end to the glory of the Yoshioka school. Musashi knew Yoshioka Kenpo's name was still revered throughout the country. In western Japan, particularly, it would have been difficult to find a fief in which there were no samurai who had not studied under him. Musashi told Shima he understood their hatred of him, but regarded it as a personal grudge rather than a legitimate reason for revenge in accordance with the art of war. Shima apparently agreed.
I called the survivors in and reprimanded them. I hope you'll forgive us and forget the matter. Gunbei, too, was very displeased. If you don't mind, I'd like to introduce him to you. He would like to offer his apologies.
That's not necessary. What happened was a common occurrence for any man committed to the martial arts.
Even so.
Well, let's dispense with the apologies. But if he'd like to talk about the way, I'd be delighted to meet him. The name is familiar. A man was sent for Gunbei, and when the introductions were over, the talk turned to swords and swordsmanship. Musashi said,
I'd like to hear about the Togun style. Did you create it?
No, replied Gunbei. I learned it from my teacher, Kawasaki Kaginosuke, from Echizen Province. According to the manual he gave me, he developed it while living as a hermit on Mount Hakun in Kozuke. He seems to have learned many of his techniques from a Tendai monk named Togunbo. But tell me about yourself. I've heard your name mentioned a number of times. I had the impression you were older, and since you're here, I wonder if you'd favor me with a lesson.
The tone was friendly. Nevertheless, this was an invitation to battle.
Some other time, Musashi replied lightly. I should be going now. I don't really know the way home. When you go, said Shima, I'll send someone with you.
When I heard two men had been cut down, Gunbei went on, I went over to take a look. I found I couldn't reconcile the positions of the bodies with the wounds, so I questioned the man who escaped. His impression was that you were using two swords at once. Could that be true?
With a smile, Musashi said he had never done so consciously. He regarded what he was doing as fighting with one body and one sword.
You shouldn't be so modest, said Gunbei. Tell us about it. How do you practice? What do the weights have to be for you to use two swords freely?
Seeing he wasn't going to be able to leave before he gave some sort of an explanation, he directed his eyes around the room. They came to rest on two muskets in the alcove, and he asked to borrow them. Shima consented, and Musashi went to the middle of the room, holding the two weapons by the barrels, one in each hand. Musashi raised one knee and said,
Two swords are as one sword. One sword is as two swords. One's arms are separate. They both belong to the same body. In all things, the ultimate reasoning is not dual, but single. All styles and all factions are alike in this respect. I will show you.
The words came out spontaneously, and when they stopped, he raised his arm and said,
By your leave.
Then he began twirling the muskets. They spun around like reels, creating a small whirlwind. The other men blanched. Musashi stopped and drew his elbows to his sides. He walked over to the alcove and put the muskets back. With a slight laugh, he said, "Perhaps that will help you to understand." Offering no further explanation, he bowed to his host and took his leave. Astounded, Shima forgot all about sending someone with him. Outside the gate, Musashi turned for a final look, relieved to be out of Watari Shima's grasp. He still did not know the man's real intentions, but one thing was clear. Not only was his identity known, he had become involved in an incident. The wisest thing would be to leave Okazaki this very night. He was thinking about his promise to Matahachi to wait for Gudo's return when the lights of Okazaki came into view and a voice called to him from a small roadside shrine.
"Musashi, it's me, Matahachi. We were worried about you, so we came out here to wait."
"Worried?" said Musashi.
"We went to your house. The woman next door said people had been spying on you recently."
"We?"
"The master came back today."
Gudo was seated on the veranda of the shrine. He was a man of unusual mien, his skin as black as a giant cicada's, his deep-set eyes shining brilliantly under high eyebrows. He looked to be somewhere between 40 and 50, but it was impossible to tell with a man like this. Thin and wiry, he had a booming voice. Musashi went over, knelt, and lowered his forehead to the ground. Gudo regarded him silently for a minute or two.
"It's been a long time," he said.
Lifting his head, Musashi said quietly, "A very long time." Gudo or Takuan, Musashi had long been convinced that only one or the other of these two men could deliver him from his present impasse. Here, at last, after a wait of a whole year, was Gudo. He gazed at the priest's face as he might at the moon on a dark night. Suddenly and forcefully, he cried out,
"Sensei!" "What is it?"
Gudo had no need to ask. He knew what Musashi wanted, anticipated it, as a mother divines a child's needs. Musashi, head to the ground again, said,
"It's been nearly 10 years since I studied under you."
"Is it that long?"
"Yes, but even after all those years, I doubt my progress along the way is measurable."
"You still talk like a child, don't you? You couldn't have come very far."
"I'm full of regrets."
"Are you?"
"My training and self-discipline have accomplished so little."
"You're always talking about such things. So long as you do that, it's futile."
"What would happen if I gave up?"
"You'd be tied up in knots again. You'd be human rubbish, worse off than before, when you were merely an ignorant fool."
"If I desert the way, I fall into the depths. Yet when I try to pursue it to the peak, I find I'm not up to the task. I'm twisting in the wind halfway up, neither the swordsman nor the human being I want to be."
"That seems to sum it up."
"You can't know how desperate I've been. What should I do? Tell me, how can I free myself from inaction and confusion?"
"Why ask me? You can only rely on yourself."
"Let me sit at your feet again and receive your chastisement. Me and Matahachi, or give me a blow with your staff to awaken me from this dark emptiness. I beg you, sensei, help me."
Musashi had not lifted his head. He shed no tears, but his voice choked up. Completely unmoved, Gudo said,
"Come, Matahachi."
And together they walked away from the shrine. Musashi ran after the priest, grabbed his sleeve, pleaded and begged. The priest shook his head silently. When Musashi persisted, he said,
"Not one thing!"
Then angrily,
"What have I to tell you? What more have I to give you? There is only a blow on the head."
He waved his fist in the air but did not strike. Musashi, letting go of his sleeve, was about to say something else. The priest walked rapidly away, not pausing to look back. At Musashi's side, Matahachi said,
"When I saw him at the temple and explained our feelings and why we wanted to become his disciples, he barely listened. When I finished, he said, 'Oh?' and told me I could follow along and wait on him. Maybe if you just follow us, whenever he seems to be in a good mood, you can ask him what you want to ask."
Gudo turned and called Matahachi.
"Coming," said Matahachi. "Do what I told you," he advised Musashi as he rushed off to catch up with the priest.
Thinking that letting Gudo out of his sight again would be fatal, Musashi decided to follow Matahachi's advice. In the flow of universal time, a man's life of 60 or 70 years was only a lightning flash. If, in that brief span, he was privileged to meet a man like Gudo, it would be foolish to let the chance slip by.
"It's a sacred opportunity," he thought.
Warm tears gathered at the corners of his eyes. He had to follow Gudo to the end of the earth if need be, pursue him until he heard the word he longed for. Gudo walked away from Hachijo Hill, apparently no longer interested in the temple there. His heart had already begun to flow with the water and the clouds. When he reached the Tokaido, he turned west toward Kyoto. The Circle. The Zen master's approach to travel was whimsically eccentric. One day when it rained, he stayed inside the inn all day and had Matahachi give him a moxa treatment. In Mino province, he stopped over at the Daisenji for 7 days and then spent a few days at a Zen temple in Hikone, so it was only gradually that they approached Kyoto. Musashi slept wherever he could find a place. When Gudo stayed at an inn, he spent the night either outdoors or at another inn. If the priest and Matahachi were stopping at a temple, Musashi took shelter under the gate. Privations were as nothing compared to his need for a word from Gudo. One night, outside a temple by Lake Biwa, suddenly aware of the coming of autumn, he took a look at himself and saw that he resembled nothing so much as a beggar. His hair, of course, was a rat's nest, since he'd resolved not to comb it until the priest relented. It was weeks since he'd had a bath and a shave. His clothes were quickly being reduced to tatters. They felt like pine bark rubbing against his skin. The stars seemed ready to fall from the sky. He looked at his reed mat and thought, "What a fool I am." All at once, his attitude appeared insane. He laughed bitterly. He'd stuck to his goal doggedly, silently, but what was it he was seeking from the Zen master? Was it impossible to go through life without torturing himself so? He even began to feel sorry for the lice inhabiting his body. Gudo had stated unequivocally that he had not one thing to offer. It was unreasonable to press him for something he did not possess, wrong to resent him, even though he showed less consideration than he might have for a stray dog along the wayside. Musashi gazed upward through the hair hanging over his eyes. No doubt about it, it was an autumn moon. But the mosquitoes. His skin, already peppered with red welts, was no longer sensitive to their bites. He was quite prepared to admit to himself that there was something he did not understand, but he thought of it as being one thing. If only he could figure out what it was, his sword would be released from its bonds. Everything else would be solved in an instant. Then, just as he felt on the verge of grasping it, it always eluded him. If his pursuit of the way was to end here, he would prefer to die, for he saw nothing else to live for. He stretched out under the roof of the gate. When sleep would not come, he asked what it could be. A sword technique? No, not only that. A secret for getting on in the world? No, more than that. A solution to the problem of Otsu? No, no man could be this miserable over the love of a woman. It had to be one all-encompassing answer. Yet for all its magnitude, it could, at the same time, be no larger than a poppy seed. Wrapped in his matting, he looked like a caterpillar. He wondered if Matahachi was sleeping well. Comparing himself with his friend, he felt envious. Matahachi's problems did not seem to disable him. Musashi always seemed to be searching out new problems with which to torture himself. His eyes fell on a plaque hanging on a gatepost. He got up and went up to it for a closer look. By the light of the moon, he read, "I beg you, try to find the fundamental source." Pai Yun was moved by the merits of Pai Chang. Hu Chou sighed over the teachings left by Pai Yun. Like our great predecessors, do not merely pinch off the leaves or concern yourselves only with the branches. It appeared to be a quotation from the Testament of Daito Kokushi, the founder of the Daitokuji. Musashi reread the last two lines. Leaves and branches. How many people were thrown off course by irrelevant matters? Was he himself not an example? While the thought seemed to lighten his burden, his doubts would not go away. Why would his sword not obey him? Why did his eyes wander from his goal? What prevented him from achieving serenity? Somehow, it all seemed so unnecessary. He knew that it was when one had pursued the way as far as possible that vacillation set in and one was attacked by fretfulness, leaves and branches. How did one break through the cycle? How did one get at the core and destroy it? I laugh at my 10-year pilgrimage, wilted robe, tattered hat, knocking at Zen gates. In reality, the Buddha's law is simple. Eat your rice, drink your tea, wear your clothes. Musashi recalled this verse written by Gudo in self-mockery. Gudo had been about the same age Musashi was now when he composed it. On Musashi's first visit to the Myoshinji, the priest had all but kicked him away from the door.
"What strange line of thinking leads you to my house?" he had shouted.
But Musashi persisted, and later, after he'd gained admittance, Gudo regaled him with this ironic verse, and he laughed at him, saying the same thing he had said a few weeks ago,
"You're always talking. It's futile."
Thoroughly disheartened, Musashi gave up the idea of sleep and walked around the gate. Just in time to see two men emerge from the temple. Gudo and Matahachi were walking at an unusually rapid pace. Perhaps an urgent summons had come from the Myoshinji, the head temple of Gudo's sect. In any event, he brushed past the monks gathered to see him off and headed straight for the Kara Bridge in Seta. Musashi followed, through the town of Sakamoto, which was asleep, the woodblock print shops, the greengrocers, even the bustling inns, all tightly shuttered. The only presence was the ghostly moon. Leaving the town, they climbed Mount Hiei, past the Miidera and the Sekiji in their veils of mist. They met almost no one. When they reached the pass, Gudo stopped and said something to Matahachi. Below them lay Kyoto, in the other direction, the tranquil expanse of Lake Biwa. Aside from the moon itself, everything was like mica, a sea of soft, silvery mist. Reaching the pass a few moments later, Musashi was startled to find himself only a few feet from the master. Their eyes met for the first time in weeks. Gudo said nothing. Musashi said nothing.
"Now, it has to be now,"
thought Musashi. If the priest got as far as the Myoshinji, it might be necessary to wait many weeks for the opportunity to see him again.
"Please, sir,"
he said. His chest swelled and his neck twisted. His voice sounded like that of a frightened child, attempting to tell his mother something he really did not want to say. He edged forward timidly. The priest did not condescend to ask what he wanted. His face might have belonged to a dry lacquer statue. The eyes alone stood out whitely, glaring angrily at Musashi.
"Please, sir,"
Musashi, oblivious of everything save the flaming impulse propelling him forward, fell to his knees and bowed his head.
"One word of wisdom. Just one word."
He waited for what seemed like hours. When he was unable to restrain himself any longer, he started to renew his plea.
"I've heard all that,"
Gudo interrupted.
"Matahachi talks about you every night. I know all there is to know, even about the woman."
The words were like slivers of ice. Musashi could not have lifted his head if he wanted to.
"Matahachi, a stick."
Musashi shut his eyes, steeling himself for the blow. But instead of striking, Gudo drew a circle around him. Without another word, he threw the stick away and said,
"Let's go, Matahachi."
They walked away quickly. Musashi was incensed. After the weeks of cruel mortifications he'd undergone in a sincere effort to receive a teaching, Gudo's refusal was far more than a lack of compassion. It was heartless, brutal. He was toying with a man's life.
"Swine of a priest!"
Musashi glared viciously at the departing pair, his lips set tightly in an angry scowl. "Not one thing." Reflecting on Gudo's words, he decided they were deceitful, suggesting the man had something to offer when in fact there was not one thing in his foolish head.
"Wait and see," thought Musashi. "I don't need you."
He would rely on no one. In the final analysis, there was no one to rely on but himself. He was a man, just as Gudo was a man and all the earlier masters had been men. He stood up, half lifted by his own rage. For several minutes, he stared at the moon, but as his anger cooled, his eyes fell to the circle. Still inside it, he turned all the way around. As he did so, he remembered the stick that had not struck him. A circle. What could it mean? He let his thoughts flow. A perfectly round line. No beginning, no end, no deviation. If expanded infinitely, it would become the universe. If contracted, it would become co-equal with the infinitesimal dot in which his soul resided. His soul was round. The universe was round. Not two, one. One entity, himself and the universe. With a click, he drew his sword and held it out diagonally. His shadow resembled the katakana symbol for O. The universal circle remained the same. By the same token, he himself was unchanged. Only the shadow had changed. "Only a shadow," he thought. "The shadow is not my real self." The wall against which he had been beating his head was a mere shadow. The shadow of his confused mind. He raised his head, and a fierce shout broke from his lips. With his left hand, he held out his short sword. The shadow changed again, but the image of the universe, not by one whit. The two swords were but one, and they were part of the circle. He sighed deeply. his eyes had been opened. Looking up at the moon again, he saw that its great circle could be regarded as identical with the sword or with the soul of one who treads the earth.
"Sensei!"
he cried, bounding off after Gudo. He sought nothing more from the priest, but he owed him an apology for having hated him with such vehemence. After a dozen steps, he halted.
"It's only leaves and branches," he thought.
Shikama Blue.
"Is Otsu here?"
"Yes, here I am."
A face appeared above the top of the hedge.
"You're the hemp dealer, Mambe, aren't you?" said Otsu.
"That's right. Sorry to bother you when you're busy, but I heard some news that might interest you."
"Come in."
She gestured toward the wooden door in the fence. As was evident from the cloth hanging from branches and poles, the house belonged to one of the dyers who made the sturdy fabric known throughout the country as Shikama Blue. This involved immersing the cloth in indigo dye several times and pounding it in a large mortar after each immersion. The thread became so saturated with dye that it wore out long before it faded. Otsu was not yet used to handling the mallet, but she worked hard, and her fingers were stained blue. In Edo, after learning Musashi was gone, she had called at the Hojo and Yagyu residences, then immediately set out on her search again. In Sakai the previous summer, she boarded one of Kobayashi Torozaemon's ships and came to Shikama, a fishing village situated on the triangular estuary where the Shikama River flows into the inland sea. Remembering that her wet nurse was married to a dyer from Shikama, Otsu had looked her up and was living with her. Since the family was poor, Otsu felt obliged to help with the dyeing, which was the work of the young unmarried women. They often sang as they worked, and villagers said they could tell from the sound of a girl's voice whether she was in love with one of the young fishermen. Having washed her hands and wiped the sweat from her forehead, Otsu invited Mambe to sit down and rest on the veranda. He declined with a wave of his hand and said,
"You came from the village of Miyamoto, didn't you?"
"Yes.
I go up that way on business to buy hemp, and the other day I heard a rumor."
"Yes?"
"About you."
"Me?"
"I also heard something about a man named Musashi."
"Musashi?"
Otsu's heart was in her throat, and her cheeks flushed. Mambe gave a little laugh. Though it was autumn, the sun was still fairly strong. He folded a hand towel, put it on his head, and squatted on his heels.
"Do you know a woman named Ogin?" he asked.
"You mean Musashi's sister?"
Mambe nodded vigorously.
"I ran into her at Mikazuki Village in Sayo. I happened to mention your name. She looked very surprised."
"Did you tell her where I was?"
"Yes. I didn't see any harm in that."
"Where is she living now?"
"She's staying with a samurai named Hirata, a relative of hers, I think. She said she'd like very much to see you. She said several times how much she missed you, how much she had to tell you. Some of it was secret, she said. I thought she was going to start crying."
Otsu's eyes reddened.
"There in the middle of the road was no place to write a letter, of course, so she asked me to tell you to come to Mikazuki. She said she'd like to come here, but couldn't just now."
Mambe paused.
"She didn't go into details, but she said she'd had word from Musashi."
He added that he was going to Mikazuki the next day and suggested she go with him. Though Otsu's mind was made up right then, she felt she should talk it over with the dyer's wife.
"I'll let you know this evening," she said.
"Fine. If you decide to go, we should get an early start."
With the sea murmuring in the background, his voice sounded particularly loud, and even Otsu's soft reply seemed rather shrill. As Mambe went out the gate, a young samurai who had been sitting on the beach rubbing a handful of sand stood up and watched him with piercing eyes, as if to verify his thoughts about the man. handsomely attired and wearing a straw basket hat shaped like a ginkgo leaf. He appeared to be 18 or 19 years old. When the hemp dealer was out of sight, he turned and stared at the dyer's house. Despite the excitement caused by Mambe's news, Otsu picked up her mallet and resumed her work. The sounds of other mallets, accompanied by singing, floated through the air. No sound came from Otsu's lips when she worked, but in her heart was a song of her love for Musashi. Now she silently whispered a poem from an ancient collection.
"Since our first meeting, my love has been more profound than that of others, though it matches not the hues of the cloth from Shikama."
She felt sure that if she visited Ogin, she would learn where Musashi was, and Ogin was a woman too. It would be easy to tell her her feelings. The beats of her mallet slowed to an almost languid pace. Otsu was happier than she had been for a long time. She understood the feelings of the poet. Often the sea seemed melancholy and alien. Today it was dazzling, and the waves, though gentle, appeared to be bursting with hope. She hung the cloth on a high drying pole and, heart still singing, wandered out through the open gate. Out of the corner of her eyes, she caught sight of the young samurai strolling unhurriedly along the water's edge. She had no idea who he was, but somehow he held her attention, and she noticed nothing else, not so much as a bird riding the salty breeze. Their destination was not very far. Even a woman could walk the distance with little difficulty, stopping over once on the way. It was nearly noon now.
"I'm sorry to put you to all this trouble," said Otsu.
"No trouble. You seem to have good walking legs," said Mambe.
"I'm used to traveling."
"I heard you've been to Edo. That's quite a journey for a woman traveling alone."
"Did the dyer's wife tell you that?"
"Yes. I've heard everything. The people in Miyamoto talk about it, too."
"Oh, they would," said Otsu with a little frown. "It's so embarrassing."
"You shouldn't feel embarrassed. If you love a person that much, who's to say whether you're to be pitied or congratulated? But it seems to me this Musashi is a little cold-hearted."
"Oh, he's not. Not at all."
"You don't resent the way he's acted?"
"I'm the one to blame. His training and discipline are his only interest in life, and I can't resign myself to that."
"I don't see anything wrong with the way you feel."
"But it seems to me I've caused him a lot of trouble."
"Humph! My wife should hear that. That's the way women ought to be."
"Is Ogin married?" asked Otsu.
"Ogin? Oh, I'm not quite sure," said Mambe, and changed the subject. "There's a tea house. Let's rest a while."
They went inside and ordered tea to go with their box lunches. As they were finishing, some passing grooms and porters called out in familiar tones to Mambe.
"Hey, you! Why don't you drop in on the game in Handa today? Everybody's complaining. You left with all our money the other day."
In some confusion, he shouted back, as though he hadn't understood them,
"I don't have any use for your horses today."
Then quickly to Otsu, "Shall we be going?" As they hurried out of the shop, one of the grooms said,
"No wonder he's giving us the brush off. Take a look at the girl."
"I'm going to tell your old woman on you, Mambe."
They heard more comments of this sort as they walked quickly on ahead. Asaya Mambe's shop in Shikama was certainly not among the more prominent business establishments there. He bought hemp in the nearby villages and parceled it out to the fishermen's wives and daughters to make into sails, nets, and other things. But he was the proprietor of his own enterprise, and his being on such friendly terms with common porters struck Otsu as strange. As if to dispel her unspoken doubts, Mambe said,
"What can you do with riffraff like that?
Just because I do them the favor of asking them to carry stuff from the mountains, that's no reason for them to get familiar.
They spent the night in Tatsuno, and when they left the next morning, Mambe was as kind and solicitous as ever. By the time they reached Mikazuki, it was getting dark in the foothills.
Mambe, said Otsu anxiously, isn't this Mikazuki? If we cross the mountain, we'll be in Miyamoto.
She had heard that Osugi was in Miyamoto again. Mambe halted.
Why, yes, it's just on the other side. Does it make you homesick?
Otsu lifted her eyes to the black, wavy crest of the mountains and the evening sky. The area seemed very desolate, as if somehow the people who should be there were missing.
It's only a little farther, said Mambe, walking on ahead. Are you tired?
Oh, no. Are you?
No, I'm used to this road. I come this way all the time.
Just where is Ogin's house?
Over that way, he replied, pointing. She's sure to be waiting for us.
They walked a little faster. When they reached the place where the slope became steeper, there was a scattering of houses. This was a stopover on the Tatsuno High Road. It was hardly large enough to be described as a town, but it boasted a cheap, one-tray eating place where grooms hung out and a few low-priced inns strung out on both sides of the road. Once they were past the village, Mambe declared,
"We have to climb a little now."
Turning off the road, he started up a steep flight of stone stairs leading to the local shrine. Like a small bird chirping because of a sudden drop in the temperature, Otsu sensed something out of the ordinary.
"Are you sure we haven't come the wrong way? There's no houses around here," she said.
"Don't worry. It's a lonely place, but you just sit down and rest on the shrine porch. I'll go and fetch Ogin."
"Why should you do that?"
"Have you forgotten? I'm sure I mentioned it. Ogin said there might be guests it would be inconvenient for you to run into. Her house is on the other side of this grove. I'll be back very soon."
He hurried off along a narrow path through the dark cryptomerias. As the evening sky grew darker, Otsu began to feel distinctly ill at ease. Dead leaves stirred by the wind came to rest in her lap. Idly she picked one up and turned it around in her fingers. Foolishness or purity, something made her the perfect picture of virginity. A loud cackling came suddenly from behind the shrine. Otsu jumped to the ground.
"Don't move, Otsu!"
commanded a hoarse, scary voice. Otsu gasped and put her hands over her ears. Several shadowy shapes came from behind the shrine and surrounded her quaking form. Though her eyes were shut, she could clearly see one of them, more frightening and seemingly larger than the others, the white-haired hag she had so often seen in nightmares.
"Thank you, Mambe," said Osugi. "Now, gag her before she starts screaming and take her to Shimonosho. Be quick about it."
She spoke with the fearsome authority of the King of Hell, condemning a sinner to the inferno. The four or five men were apparently village toughs, having some connection with Osugi's clan. Shouting their assent, they went at Otsu like wolves fighting over prey, and tied her up so that only her legs were free.
"Take the shortcut! Move!"
Osugi remained behind to settle with Mambe. As she fished the money from her obi, she said,
"Good of you to bring her. I was afraid you might not be able to manage it."
Then she added,
"Don't say a word to anybody."
With a satisfied look, Mambe tucked the money into his sleeve.
"Oh, it wasn't so hard," he said. "Your plan worked just fine."
"Ah, that was something to see. Frightened, wasn't she?"
"She couldn't even run. Just stood there. Ha ha. But maybe it was rather wicked of us."
"What's wicked about it? If you only knew what I've been through."
"Yes, yes, you told me all about it. Well,
I can't be wasting time here. I'll see you again one of these days. Come visit us in Shimonosho.
Be careful. That path's not easy walking, he called over his shoulder as he started back down the long, dark steps.
Hearing a gasp,